Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
So today we're here with World War II veteran John Skeen. John, thank you so much for spending your afternoon with me. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
So give us a little background on you. I understand you were drafted in 41?
Yes, I registered for the September 40, and was issued a number. Everyone was issued a number, and my number was called in January 41.
Where did you grow up?
Charleston, West Virginia.
And when you got called up, I believe I read that before you got called up that you were quite an athlete in high school, and that you even potentially would have been drafted to the Cincinnati Reds?
Well, yes, sir. I guess I was a little above average as an athlete. I made the All-State basketball team 2 years in a row, made the All-State football team 2 years in a row, and then after I graduated from high school, they had a semi-pro league, which was called a tri-state league with Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia teams in it. And I went immediately in and had a tryout and made the team. And so I played 1 year after I got out of high school in a semi-pro before I went to work for DuPont. DuPont, all the chemical plants along the river had teams, had a league. And so I was playing for DuPont. And at Cincinnati, I had a farm club, AAA farm club in Charleston. And so at the end of the season, they picked an all-star out of the semi-pro team to play the regular Cincinnati ball club on the closing out the season. So I was picked on the all-star team and to play the exhibition game with Cincinnati. And after the game was over with, I was approached by a person who turned out to be a scout, and he said, if you have some time, we'd like to talk to you. And not only myself, but there's three other fellows. They took all four of us over into this room and said, we think maybe perhaps you'll have a potential of being a professional baseball player. And so I was always the smallest man on about every team I played on.
Sure.
And but Kevin has heard me say this before. The scout talked to us for a few minutes there, and he said we'll have 2 weeks from now, we'll be having a tryout session. He said, we'd like to have, we pulled you all, you four, out of the league to try out for the spot on our farm club system. I said, would you be willing to do that? And I said, okay. And so 2 weeks later, we reported there in Charleston, went through a system of different things. But you know, the strange and funny thing was that they never asked me to bat. They never asked me to field. And so when it was all of their timing, what they did, they timed me from first, from home to first, from home to second, or from first to third, and bunt. I was always the fastest man on about any team I played on. So after it's over with, the scout sat down there and talked to us, and he said, you know, fellas, that we can teach you to hit, and we can teach you to bat. But said, you fellas have got something we can't do it. That's speed, and that's what we're looking for. So I was to report to rookie league D club, class D in Richmond, Virginia in the spring of 41. But Uncle Sam said you were reporting to my team.
He wanted your speed.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think where the Cincinnati Reds would have played back then, because I'm actually from the tri-state area. I was born in northern Kentucky, right out in Erlanger, right outside of Cincinnati. And so I can visualize where the stadium is and where it used to be. I'm trying to think of where the Reds would have played back in 41
oh,
in
yeah.
that general area.
Yeah, They ran a train when Cincinnati was home. They ran a train out of Charleston on weekend to Cincinnati, and often when I went, my brother was interested in sports too, and so we'd go down on a Friday and stay, see ball game on Saturday and Sunday, and come back on Sunday evening, you know. So, but I saw, I met a lot of old Joe Nutsala. I had a lot of conversation with him. He turned out after playing for Cincinnati, he became an announcer, you know, for many years for the Cincinnati Ball Club.
So when your number came up, if you will, were you conflicted? Because here is your opportunity to play for the Cincinnati Baseball Club, and then your opportunity to fight for your country.
Well, of course, I was somewhat disappointed, but still, I looked forward, like a lot of other young fellows who didn't have an opportunity for much anything during the Depression Day, to go, you know, to either work for DuPont or make a decision to play, try out for the Cincinnati Farm Club. So I hadn't reached that decision yet because he called me in January. I would have had to make up my mind, you know, between then and the spring training.
Now, being from what, from your family being from West Virginia, was the coal mines part of your family, or did you, were you guys lucky enough not to go that route?
No, you know, back in 1918, when I was born, that was a big flu epidemic. People were dying by the hundreds of thousands all the world over.
Spanish flu?
And my mother said, I remember her saying, you could look out the window about any time during the day. I lived right in the city, and said you could see a hearse or an ambulance going down to pick up someone who was dead. People were afraid to go out of the house. It was so terrible. Well, I lost my father. I was only 2 months old.
Oh.
He died. I lost a three-year-old brother. I lost my grandmother, one of my grandmothers. And my uncles and aunts and cousins, we all mounted up to 21 that died during that epidemic.
That's a tremendous amount of loss. I can't imagine your mother dealing with that.
Yeah, she was a widow. She never remarried. I had two brothers. They went to Ohio to work for my, I forget the name of the restaurant chain, had a huge farm, and they were...
Bob Evans?
Huh?
Bob Evans?
No, not Bob. Anyway, Stouffer's.
Okay.
Stouffer's.
Stouffer's, yeah. Gotcha.
And my uncle was a manager, and they had hundreds of, you know, raised all the food there. And they were there, and so I was left pretty much on my own. I grew up a part, sort of a roughing. I had to make it on my own because on the street that I lived on, there were three other guys. They were older than me, but I held my own with them. We got in scuffles all the time, and so I didn't take any lip from anybody. Even though I was small as I was. And so my mother worked, she was one of four families out of 20-some on that street that had a job.
Yeah.
Nobody had it yet. No work. She worked in the laundry, worked 12 hours a day, 6 in the morning and 6 in the evening. And I was left pretty much on my own. The neighbors sort of overlooked me when I came in from school. And when I went to junior high school, which was about a mile and a half away from where I lived, I'd run from, at noontime, I'd run all the way home, get me a peanut butter sandwich, and then run back. So things were really tough. And the great highlight of the whole week, as far as food was concerned, my mother would go down to the farmer's market. Farmers came in from around the area and displayed all their stuff, eggs, and said she'd buy a live chicken.
Yeah.
She'd bring that chicken home. I can remember just as the plainest day, she'd tie the legs and hang it on a clothesline, whack the head off. And boy, Sunday was our big day. We had chicken for Sunday. Otherwise, it was bologna, peanut butter and jelly. And sometimes liver was cheap. We had.
It's amazing how some of that stuff doesn't change even over 40 years. And the reason I say that, your mom had the wherewithal to tie the chicken's legs together. I was born in 78, so in the early 80s, we lived in the farmhouse that used to be my great-grandfather's dairy farm. My grandfather left Eastern Kentucky, coal miners, moved to Richwood, Kentucky, got a job at a dairy farm that turned out to be my great-grandfather's. That's where my grandfather and my grandmother met. But in the 80s, we lived on that property, which had then been parceled off. But as you know, late 70s and 80s, there was a recession and jobs were scarce.
Yeah.
So my mom would get some chickens. But when she cut the head off, she didn't have the foresight to tie the legs together. So damn things would run around the yard, splurting blood everywhere until they finally fell over. And then we too would have the chicken, or we would catch snapping turtles out of the pond. And one of the things that still carry over to this day for me is my appreciation for raw potatoes. Because once again, we didn't have a lot of money, but we had access to tomatoes, green beans, corn on the cob, and raw potatoes. So to this day, I don't do it as often, but I did a lot as a teenager. I'd just peel a potato, get some salt, and just go to town eating raw potatoes, because that's what we ate when we were extremely poor in the 80s. And so it's interesting to hear that some of the experiences you had in the 30s still carried over to a lot of people in Kentucky and West Virginia in the late 70s and 80s during that part of the recession that we went through.
Yes, we were called the Depression Kids. They referred to us later on, you know. You were one of the Depression Kids you grew up doing. But looking back, you know, we were poor, dirt poor. But I didn't realize it because everybody else was poor around us. And the thing, I never even gave them any thought as to what, you know, a desire for whatever was out there, you know. I was just taking care of myself, and everybody told me I did a pretty good job.
Well, I mean, it makes you wonder how different the outcome of the war would have been if you guys didn't live through the Depression up to that. Because as you were saying, you guys were already used to eating minimum access to food, which would come in handy during combat. You're talking about getting in scrapes with kids at school. You didn't back down from anybody. Kind of toughened you up. So I'm sure when you got to boot camp and you're learning fighting skills and self-defense skills and tactics for combat, I'm sure, you know, that came in handy. So it's curious to think of if the outcome would have been different if your generation wasn't toughened through the Great Depression beforehand.
Well, as I say, when I was drafted into the, they saw what was on the horizon. Japan was gobbling up every island and down through the Pacific. And Hitler was invading all these countries that exist. So they mobilized the National Guard to all over the country. And they mobilized, when I was drafted, they sent me into the West Virginia 201st Infantry National Guard, which was mobilized, and went to Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana for my basic training. And after that, a series of maneuvers, they shipped all the National Guard units out. We went to Philippines, Alaska, Panama, and so forth. I was scheduled to go to the Philippines. In fact, we loaded up, the train was getting ready, and they took us back and pulled us off and sent us to this outfit. They got caught on a corregidor, and they said they were a notch better as far as training was concerned. And so we sent us to Seattle. We caught our old 19 in World War I troop ship, USS Ulysses Grant, and they used that all through Alaskan waters and everything during the World War II. And so we boarded, they sent us there, so they shipped us, and we were the first troops to be shipped to Alaska. They thought if the United States was invaded, it would come from that direction.
Through Russia.
Because it's only 150 air miles from Japan, closer. And we got a lot of bomb on the islands that I was on. We hip-hopped when new troops came in, and they wanted to send them farther north, we would move on forward, and then they would come and occupy, you know, maybe the island was on. So I was through Sitka, Dutch Harbor, Cold Bay, and so forth, and after, got all the way around to Amchitka, the farthest northwest island that we occupied.
What months were you in Alaska? Was it summer months, winter months?
Oh, summer. I was up for 18 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you got to experience all of it.
Yeah, we went at first to be a defense, primary a defense unit, because we had the CBs come in and everything, and the big construction company out of Seattle, Sims, great, the largest in the world, had a big stuff. But we were building fortifications, bunkers, and everything like that. We, you know, getting prepared for in case Japan did decide. And they wanted to learn later and everything, but they held off because they were doing so well everywhere else in that particular town. You didn't worry about us too much.
At what point were you transferred over to the 275th?
Well, after the Battle of Attu and Kiska, they picked out a cadre, commissioned officer, non-commissioned officer. I was a platoon sergeant already. I moved right up through the ranks because I passed every test with flying colors. I was usually the first, the head of marching and everything, or I was just a natural born athlete, someone told me. I excelled in about anything I tried. And so I moved right on up, and when we shipped out of Fort Benjamin Harrison, I was a squad leader. Went to Alaska in the first turn. Before long, I moved right on up to a platoon sergeant, rifle platoon. And so that's what I was most of the time. But when the war, when Attu and Kiska was taken by, by our troops, they picked out they said, we went back to Amchitka. That's where the largest air base we had in Alaska at that time. So I was picked out with other commissioned, non-commissioned officers to come back to states to form a new division. We were getting slaughtered, murdered, losing a lot of people. They didn't have any replacements fast enough. So they hadn't planned on any new divisions, but they decided they needed. So we went, and what happened, we went back to Fort Lewis, Washington, and this program they had, you may remember, ASTP or something it was called, Army Service Training Program.
Okay.
These were the people with a high that would bring money, that had about 300,000 throughout the universities. And they were training for, I don't know what to come, but they had a high IQ. Well, when we came back, the need was so great, they canceled that program. And we got, those are most of the troops that we got when we formed a division. Someone said, you might not be the best fighting one, but you'll be the best smartest. So that's how it came. And I came back on a cadre and to Fort Lewis, and from there they split all of us that went to different places. And I went down to Oregon, where we formed the 70th Infantry Division.
I want to back up a moment because I don't want to pass up an opportunity to discuss. You're talking about Attu. Were you part of the Battle of Attu in Alaska?
No, I wasn't. You know the story of Kiska, but you know the story of Attu. The Japs went in there and a storm took all the troops off, and there was no action combat. But I was on a ship ready to. I was the second unit supposed to go in. We were polar bear number two, that was our code. Polar bear number one was to go in. There wasn't much of a beach or anything. It just bare hillside and caves all over, you know. So they were to go in and secure the beach. And then once they secured, they were to move on, and we were to be the next unit to come in. So I'll tell you how close come. They over the speaker, they said, pull the bear to the nets. Someone said, pull the bear to the nets. So we got all our gear and everything, got there and ready to go down the nets. We waited there. And the other unit had already gone in, the first unit. We waited and waited and waited, and nothing happened. And it must have been about a half hour or more. And then over the loudspeaker said, we would not be going in because there was no need for us. They couldn't find any Japanese. And so we were ready, loaded up, ready to go down the nets when there was a cancel. I mean, that's how close. But a storm came up, one of these storms that comes up unexpected. They're called Willawas. The natives know when those storms are coming. They even beat the radar. You look out on the horizon, there's all fishing village, you know, Japanese fishing village all along. You can see those fishing boats coming in. We knew the storms, and so we batten down the hatch. And it was a close call, but at Dutch Harbor and so forth, we were bombed on and off, you know, not consistently, but I was in some bombing during the time. But actual combat, no, I did not.
This may be a weird sounding or unique question, but a lot of living historians and reenactors listen to this show. And one of the things we do when we try to portray history is to have everything correct.
Yeah.
And so we rely on firsthand accounts, photographs, and documentation as far as the minute things of what uniforms were issued. So do you remember what the weather was like when you guys were getting ready to go over before they called it off?
Oh, we laid out there 5 days while that storm lasted. And that gave the Japanese opportunity to go in there and take the Japanese off that island during that storm. Oh, you wouldn't believe the Air Force says there's worse weather in the world to fly in. They lost more planes by weather than they did when at 2 than they did from the enemy.
Were you guys wearing your M41s with wool, or did you have heavier jackets?
Did we have what?
It being Alaska and the potential bad weather, do you remember if you guys were issued your M41 jackets? Did you have the heavier trench coats on?
No, we were. You know what we wore? I had leather trousers. Leather trousers. Everything was rubber or leather. When they get ready to invade at 2, they went down in California, pulled out a unit that had been on maneuvers a month before in the desert, brought them in to make the initial landing. And here we've been laying up there all those months. That's how screwed up sometimes the armed forces are. And they brought those in, and they weren't in there about 3 or 4 days, and they had to pull half of them out. They come up a big fur line stuff and got just, you know, that's not fit for that type of weather up there. So we had our shoe packs, and we had our canvas, outer garment, and jacket, and rubber. So that's how we were able to, make it through it.
So after you got assigned to the new cadre, and they're organizing this new group, the 275th, what's your next move there on your way to Europe?
Well, after we finished up our, we hadn't completely finished our 9 months, which we were originally supposed to train combat infantrymen.
Mm-hmm.
So we was there about 2 months, I think, they had to go. They come in and pulled our regiment out, the 275th. See, we had the 274th, 275th, and 276th. But the need was so great, and in such a hurry, they pulled the 275th, which I was a member of. They thought they were the best of the three regiments. They pulled us out and shipped us in. Pulled us out and shipped us individually. We went and got with some other units, and we went to Boston, Miles Standish.
Boston.
Miles Standish. and we shipped down on the Queen Elizabeth. And of course, we landed at Marseille after, and that was our place of going into Europe for the, but no, and we didn't get together. You know, once you go into combat, you're never full strength.
Sure.
Never. And that's the same way during the course of battle. Division, after division, you know, will go over, pull a regiment out, depending on what their type of action they're going to be in. And they'll go over and pull a regiment, just like it, during the Battle of the Bulge. We were pulled, 275th was pulled out, attached to the Third Army, Patton.
Mm-hmm.
So, and once you, like I say, we were never full strength once. We didn't get together to a division until December when the other units, artillery hadn't come over, and different groups of our 70th Division, and 274th hadn't gotten over there, and we were just fighting and shift, being shifted here and there where we needed. And they shifted us the worst and most terrible ordeal I ever went through was in the Vosges Mountains in Alsace-Lorraine. Weather, about down to 15 below. Snow, 7-8 foot deep. Nothing mobile moved. Nothing. No skies, sky overcast, no air. Artillery couldn't move up or anything. And we got a book in there, what author, writer, when, said, when the odds were even, one on one. We fought there in the mountains and we gained a few, maybe a, 200-300 yards, and we'd be pushed back because we were fighting the best mountain cold weather troops that Hitler had. They had fought in Russia and Norway and Sweden. And so this was the beginning of the Ardennes campaign. So this was a southern movement. The northern movement was up and through Bastogne. The southerners were supposed to come over the mountains and get back to Strasbourg, go around and cut the 7th Army off. But they held out in Bastogne and we stopped them there in the mountains of Alsace-Lorraine.
Do you think the time that you guys spent in Alaska, out in that environment, benefited you?
Oh yes, I had a little bit of spatial training. I spent 3 weeks with Alaska Scouts. They flew us back into the boondocks and dropped us off. It was trained how to survive and that type of weather. And I was always on the move. I never had frozen feet or nothing. We've lost so many men, frozen feet there. But I was always on the move, active. I stayed right with them. I checked them. Some of the platoon leaders, once the day was over with, they'd go to the CP in the bed down wherever the company head CP was. But I never did. I'd check every foxhole. I'd check for their password, you know, and I'd stop and I'd talk to them. And finest, the most wonderful thing I ever got out of that, how the men respected me for what I did. I turned down commission twice because I'd had to be shifted over to another unit. They wouldn't return me to the unit. And so I stuck with my men, stayed with them. And I've met families over the years and men and everything, and they all pay respect that I think was worth much of what I had to do to worthwhile.
Now, we know when the Germans made their move over the Ardennes, and it was kind of unpredicted. And we know that some of the units were deployed being unprepared. Were you guys in that same unprepared state, meaning lack of winter clothing, or were you guys more prepared with the gear and supplies that you had issued before being routed along the south?
Oh, well, yeah. We've been attached to the 49th, they were attached to, our regiment was attached to the 49th Division. They were already online when we got there. it pulled us out. So we had had plenty of contact on and off with them before we before they pulled us out to Third Army, Third Division with Patton and sent us north. But the troops that we fought there in the mountains were 6th SS Mountain Division.
Wow.
They were the best Hitler had. And like I say, we'd gain a few. And you know what the Stars and Stripes referred to us, the 275th Infantry? You know what they referred to it? They said, called us, because we just gained a few guard for a whole month or more there. And they said that they didn't, they usually referred to us as the Trailblazers. They mm-hmm. didn't, never said, but they said, the Stars and Stripes come up and said, the sons of bitch. Well, where they get that bitch with the big town at the head of that was their main objective, B-I-T-C-H-E.
Gotcha.
It was an international town. Students came from all over New York to study there. And so that was the goal and our objective, to take bitch and hold it. And so we fought there all those days, like I tell you about the weather and the condition that we fought under. And one incident, I don't know whether you want to call it individual incident or not, you want me to say anything?
Go ahead.
Well, New Year's night, we'd moved up from Cadenbron, was the town we had taken the day before, and the next day was New Year's Day. We moved up to took another town called Phillipsburg, there at the foothills of the mountain. And we made preparation to relieve that outfit that was been fighting up there in Bitch. And so we hit the road at 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night, and we were supposed to, march was going to be slow, so they figured it'd take about twice as much as all the snow we had to wade through to get there. It'd be probably midnight before we were relieved. Well, we'd been out about an hour. My platoon, I didn't have a platoon, I didn't have an officer. I fought most of the time without an officer. The moon was out, just like clear daylight. So we hit the road. I was the lead point behind the scouts that was out in front. And we hit the road about an hour, and it was customary, you know, you rotate them. So I was the lead platoon, and we first break, we stopped. I fell aside, then when we moved on, they moved through and I fell in on the end of my platoon. Well, we hadn't gone just a few seconds. All hell broke loose. Everything lit up. Flares all over the place. The machine guns. Boom, boom, mortar shells started coming in on us.
So everything just lit up. Mortars, MG-42s, MG-43s.
Yeah, machine guns, you could hear them rattling, and then the flares would die down and they'd go back up. And the captain hollered, it wasn't hardly anything, a ditch was all covered up with snow, there was just nowhere to take cover, you know. And so they pretty well shot us up, but the captain did order, said, fall back, told us. And so I was on the rear end, so I fell way back, and probably 500 or 600 yards, and there was a bridge that went, we were going around the hillside slope, and it had the road, then there's a stream, then there's a railroad track. Well, I drove back, and there's a little building there, I don't know what it was used for. I got ready to set up the CP, my platoon. And I was waiting, and the people had come dwindling back down, you know, one or two or two, and got my machine gunners in place, and a BAR man, called there's a bridge, metal bridge, crossed over to a little railroad building on the other side. And so we had dropped back, and the other men started filtering back. Well, in a little bit, looked up, and to the left, here come a whole group on the railroad, come down the railroad track up in front, like 400 or 500 yards, white coats on. Here they come, it looked like a company of men almost. Here they were coming down, and it came down to where the bridge was, opposite where we were. I had my machine gun around the slope. They were behind me, and I got my BR men down there next to the road. And they were, my machine guns could fire over our head. So we got set up, and I figured that what we was going to do, they were going to cross that bridge, cut us off. Well, they came down and they stopped and they stood there and talked for probably 5 minutes and just, and I didn't know what they was going to do. But finally they decided to cross the bridge and they came across single file. Well, we gave orders to let them get about a halfway or more before anyone start firing. And so they did, they came over and we cut loose on them. Well, when daylight, when morning came, and we thought everybody that was that was available or was capable of moving had came back. And so our captain said, well, we're going to withdraw. We're going back to our point of departure then. So, but lo and behold, somehow or other, on the other side, the Germans had gotten behind and had cut us off on the road. So the captain put us, had us move up on this hillside mountain with some trees for cover. So we, but anyway, we there was seven, we killed seven men that was dead there on the, when we left there on the bridge. And some was wounded because we could see two or three got carried others back after, while we were firing, had been wounded. Anyway, we went on this hill. It's called, division called it Hill 30. They that's the way they do it. They give a number or something like that. So we got on the hill, started trying to dig in. You couldn't hardly dig or nothing. You just got the snow off, but you couldn't hardly get the ground, break the ground. But anyway, of course, during that time, we didn't have nothing to eat. And everything, the only thing I had, chocolate bars. I was a person, I didn't smoke, but I loved chocolate. So I'd trade my cigarette packages to other fellows for the chocolate bars. And I kept my combat jacket full, the two big pockets. Everybody would come to John for chocolate bars. And sometimes I'd give little kids, you know, go in town. Or
sure.
But that's all we had nothing. We had some little packages of flavors. We couldn't have any fires. They wouldn't let us have any fires or anything. Well, it was 4 days before the 274 unit had gotten up to where they could relieve us. And when they got there, we had to carry most of them. We had to carry so many men off the hill. They couldn't walk. But they took it, they brought up three trucks and loaded them up with men, and we went back about a mile to where the kitchen had been set up in an old sawmill. This was a wooden area, and it had a lot of timber work and coming out of the mountains there. And in the old place where they had hot food, they had pancakes and coffee. I didn't even mean any pancakes, but that coffee, oh my goodness, what it tastes like. It tastes better than Starbucks. So, but the next morning, after they canvassed everybody, the ones we lost was killed when we hit, and those that were pulled off the hill with frozen feet, out of the 158 men, we only had 30 men and two officers left out of that whole group. But you talk about being demoralized.
Oh, yeah.
You wouldn't believe. You know what they did? They moved us down that slope, across that creek, up a hill to another mountain, filled us in with another unit who had suffered too. After I'd been up there 4 days, boy, I tell you, that was one of the hardest setbacks I ever faced for them.
How do you think you were, was it your constant movement that kept you from freezing your feet?
I was on patrol about, Captain and I had a good relationship. I caught most of the patrol duty. How this relationship started, our captain was killed, originally Jeep ran over mine, flipped it over and everything, and shipped it out to England, but later he died. But so we got this lieutenant from 274th, came over to take over the leadership, acting captain. Well, when he came over, they called us, all the platoon leaders, runner came and said, "The captain wants to see you, the CO." So we went up this building, partly bombed out, didn't have any roof on or anything, but he had sent a CP, had a radio man there, and a runner and two or three others. And he said, he introduced himself, says, I'm Lieutenant Donahue, and I'm going to be your, I'll be the acting commander. And he asked each one of us some questions about ourselves. And then I said, he was from New Jersey. And I said, you know, Captain or Lieutenant? I said, I knew in Alaska, I knew Donahue was from New York. And I said, you did? He said, I had a brother that was in Alaska. And I said, this fellow was in the 198th Coast Artillery. And he let me out a big wow. That was my brother. I said, well, we used to call them a $1.98 outfit. But anyway, from there on, he called me for extra duty all the time. And that's most of the patrols I led. But I led three or four or five patrols at different times out trying to see find any movement on the part of the German. And then, too, I'd circulate among the men and everything. I just didn't stop. I just, I was so active.
It's kind of, I don't know if ironic's the term I'm looking for, but it's surprising and unique to hear that a combat patrol is what saved your life. Obviously, because you're moving, you're staying warm, you're constantly moving, whereas in jungle situations or maybe non-winter situations, it's safer to be back on the line in your foxhole opposed to being out in a combat patrol looking for engagement. But as you just said, because of your constant movement in these combat patrols.
Yeah, I'd say partially that was true.
The 275th, were you guys used more as an advancing troop movement, or were you guys more, with the exception of you and your combat patrols, or were they more of a defensive position dug in most of the time?
Well, we weren't supposed to be a defensive position, but because of the weather, it was the coldest winter in 50 years in 1948 there in Europe. And because of the temperature and the large snow limited us to any real active action. We mostly, holding the line, trying to keep the Germans the same way. But they suffered just the same as we did. I know, we 70th Division has we have our own website and everything doing. We go back, our group goes back to Europe every other year.
That's fantastic.
Every other year. Last year was the first time that the associate members outnumbered the regulars.
Yeah.
We have the brothers, sisters, cousins, and uncles, and aunts, and great uncles, and great-granddaughter and great-great-granddaughter. They form out every other year. We go back and visit the towns and we liberated in a different place. They declare a holiday. They shut down everything, the banks, the schools, and so forth. They organize a big parade. We have the color guard from Chief headquarters come down and we have a memorial service. And then at evening time, they put on a big banquet. And then we may have a dedication service, name this street after a certain person or building after our unit. I know that they opened up the last time I was there. I've been back three times. The last time I was there, they opened up a new community center. And they named it. I was the first. I got a picture there of signing the showed me signing the book. I was the first one, aren't you?
That's beautiful.
My platoon was lead platoon in Lexington, France, L-I-X-I-N-G. But it's a great opportunity to, and you know, they see these people, they really, really acknowledge the fact that the American soldier, their contribution and their liberation of their cities and towns was something that they can't show enough appreciation to us for. And went back, like I say, 2 years ago, this was the in between, we were on the tour, and was out down on the Rhine River, but the 6th SS Mountain Division, we've had contact with them. They had visited us over here, and we had visited some of them over there, and we took on the chat room, we talked to them, you know. So when we went back this time before last, they came down, picked us up. We had 3 busloads. We had 100 and some, I forget now. Picked us up, took us back up into the Alps, to big chalet, great big building, huge double doors. And when we got off the bus, they said, line up in a single file, which we did. And said, we'll tell you when to move. So we was there a few minutes, and the doors opened, and they moved us in. And this was like a big auditorium, basketball arena or something. But they had 3 big tables, one end clear to the other end. And they had the stage and the podium and everything on. So we sat down. We sat there a few minutes, and the side door opened. And here come these SS troops from Mountain Division who fought against. Same one. They came in, and they took a seat opposite each one of us. Most of them speak English, you know. We didn't have any trouble with conversation. And so we had a short time of fellowship before we had the meal. Then after the meal, this person came to the podium and found out later he was a colonel of one of the outfits we'll be fighting against in the mountains. So he took the podium and he stood there and he just looked up and down, just went up and I didn't think he was ever going to speak, but finally he did. And this is the gist of what he said, maybe not word by word. But he said, gentlemen, who would have ever thought that such a thing could happen? Here, 50 years ago, we were there in the mountains of House Vasily, froze together, hungry, dirty, filthy, not knowing we'd be living the next day, and now here we sit breaking bread together. I never forgot it.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, it's very vivid. I can see.
Do you remember the day, maybe after the action, the day that Bastogne and the Bulge, that campaign was finally claimed to have been completed, that you're all moving out, your time in the dug in and that area was over, it's time to move on?
Well, a little after Christmas, I think, as I recall. We were on the outskirts. We had received artillery, but our unit that we were attached to, didn't get in. 101st Airborne, where, you know, they were surrounded. But we received artillery. That's closest, you know, as far as any action or any involvement we had, because we were attached. 275th was attached to the Third Army, Third Division.
I understand that you received 2 Purple Hearts due to injuries, one from shrapnel and one from a bullet. What campaigns did you acquire those in?
Well, there's not any. I can't truthfully say that it was a campaign. It was just action, daily action that was involved in. Neither one of them was any particular. campaign, as you say.
Maybe the phrase campaign's not the correct phrase, but do you remember what at? Was it in Bastogne area? Was it another patrol?
It was one before and one after. We had a critique one night. All the platoon leaders and battalion commander came down, and it was in the Lorraine Valley. We were moving up the Lorraine Valley. We were having a lot of success, you know. The towns weren't large, they were sort of small. You used to have a town, then you'd have maybe bare hillside where the animals fed or so forth, then you'd have woods, you know. And it was just typical like that. We have one, and you'd have another. Just, like, just hop, 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 you know. And we were doing real well. Well, we moved out. We left a line of departure at dark, just daylight. Got up the hill. We received some machine gun fire, but it was light. We got into the woods, and we started through the. They thought we'd get through the woods in one day, but we just got about a third of the way in when we ran into a lot of firepower. They had bunkers all staggered all through the woods. Now their bunkers were, you'd be surprised how many types of bunkers you run into.
Sure.
There in the woods, they dig down about 3 feet and then it'd log up about 3 feet and put brush over the top of it. That was the type of it. So we were on the left flank, my platoon was, and we got ran into this heavy machine gun fire, was held up. Captain called the squad platoon leaders over, and we discussed what we were going to do. And on the other side was a big drop off a cliff where the mining something, I don't know what it was, don't recall at all. But anyway, it wasn't hardly any way we could advance. And we sit there and talked for a while, and I got the idea. I said that where they cut the brush back in the trees for a field of fire, 180 degrees, you know, for a field of fire for the machine guns, we could see the bunker up ahead, see the fire coming out of it about 100 yards or more. So I said, well, that brush is all piled up there. I think we got room enough. We could work our way up past behind that brush piles up to get up to where the bunker's at. And we discussed it and said, oh, all right. Say, he said, Sergeant, what do you want? I said, well, I need a bazooka man, I think, most important, and maybe one or two of the rifle grenades. So I had four myself, as five of us. So we started out, and I said, I had to walkie-talkie. I said, I'll contact you whenever we're going to charge the bunker. So what we did, we worked our way slow. It took about 20 minutes, and we crawled and walked a little bit and crawled and got up, not quite opposite, but slightly at an angle. And we could see, oh, the bunker, plain sight, a gun. So I told the bazooka man, go ahead, fire. He only had three rounds. He fired the first one and went over the top of it. But the second one he fired was a direct hit. That thing, bunker, flew all apart, dirt, dust, everything, like a smoke screen. You wouldn't believe what it looked like. And so when cleared up a little bit, I told my other squad leader who was with me, I said, okay, let's go up. So I took off toward the bunker with him. Well, something I'm not quite sure, but out of the back ran three people with, they had the old long coats on, and he and I, we were within probably 50 yards of it. We both were cutting loose with our rifles, and two fell, and one got into the woods But when it got up to where he was, this one guy was hitting a knee and he was crawling over around. The other one was face down. And I took the butt end of my barrel of a rifle and I unflipped it over, and it was a woman. She had been there, her mother, she had one of the long guns. Well, anyway, we knocked the bunker out, and next day we took the woods, and next day we went into this little town. We explained to the burgomaster that we killed a woman up there. He said, "Well, I'm not surprised, that's not unusual." He said, "These women go out at nighttime with food and stay in the bunkers overnight and get back in before daylight." So it killed that woman. They said, the morning reports and everything said Sergeant Skeen killed a woman. Well, I'm not sure I killed. My squad leader was also side to side. We both were firing at the same time. But the morning report said I killed a woman. And so, I don't know. But anyway, the one I got shot through the arm was moving up this little town. I had half my squad platoon on one side, and I was on that right side and the other on the left side, and we were moving up, you know, slowly and like, and the one on the left was held up. I'd gotten too far ahead, so I came back to run across the street on the other side. Well, out of the second story window, I didn't know it at the time, but you know, the morning reports, but by the time they go through the system, up to the battalion, consolidators, and on up to regiments, and by the time they get to division headquarters, we don't know how many people has handled them.
Yeah.
And I know for truthfully, a lot of them are not accurate. I know that because I had the morning reports. I won't tell you how I got them, but they're censored.
That's need no basis.
They're censored. I got them. And all these years, when meetings we've been in, 274, 2750, said, "How in the world did you get all those? How did you get censored morning reports?" Well, I said, I'd never tell anyone. But what happened, really happened, our company clerk, I think he made duplicate copies of our company, if I did. He had got pneumonia, which he never did come back to the company. But he took these records with him, because whenever he died, he lived out west, I forget, Colorado somewhere. I got a call from his widow and told me, "We've got some boxes here and that Carl had brought back from the service. Said, you're the one most important person that he speaks of and has contact with." And I did. I called him on the phone, cars and everything. And he said, "Would you like to have them?" And I said, "Yes, I think I would." So she sent them to me, and that's how I got in position. All I best I can know is he made duplicate copies and got those things out. But it gives a morning report, the date, so and so, how many replacements got, gives her name, KIA, MIA, PW. He got a message, date. I got files. And
did it have the report from when you got hit? Said, did it have the report from when you got hit? You're talking about getting shot in the arm.
No, it just says I'm just wounded, it all said. Just WIA, I told them.
Do you remember the
other one? The one that we're talking about, it was, like I say, it's all different types of bunkers.
Sure.
The Spectrum Heights, big concrete bunkers. And then the odd thing was, it had some smaller ones on the slope, and then back on ridge line with these great big, but these smaller ones. I guess that's when I got shot in the harbor, knocking out one of those bunkers. When I got to then the shrapnel, Grossbriefdorf. Can you imagine that? Such a town name. I got some shrapnel when artillery came in on us as we were moving, but I got hit in the calf of my leg, in the back of my leg. But and one of the most unusual bunker you'll ever see, we were in this town moving up the street, and when you started to get just daylight, you know, we always jumped off at daylight.
Sure.
Everybody.
What was the reason for that? Why was there not too many nighttime actions?
Huh?
What was the reason for most, it seems, battle actions that take place early morning? Why never any nighttime action?
Well, we could move up and get to the line of departure under cover of darkness.
Oh, okay.
See? Moving the troops up. We'd usually leave our place of, you know, where we'd occupy, maybe open ground and everything, and they, all the hills were sloping, and trees on them, but they wasn't trees. They just stood like telephone poles, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and the same way down there in Lorraine Valley, those big orchards, wine and apple orchards, as far as you could see, it didn't look like vineyards. They were just like a corn stalk winter time on a farm or something.
Yeah.
That's what they looked like. But anyway, we were getting far, and somebody said, "Where's that coming from?" We could tell it. It's spasmodic, is it on or not? Do you know what? That machine gun was in a manure pile. All the houses, they bring the animals in the evening, and they quartered right beside the house. They used everything they could for fertilizer, and so all of them had big manure piles, and they had boarded up inside, left a lot of manure over, and they knocked that thing out of manure.
That's
and you know, like somebody said, well, how often is, how do you know it's a German or foreign at you or something? He said, your men are all around you, the other foreign. I said, well, you could tell a machine gun, a German machine gun from American. American would go, pop, 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 pop. That German would go, about twice as far apart as ours. And then you learn so much. The artillery, you learn what's going over. You can hear a buzz bomb coming. We didn't worry too much about that because we knew they weren't going to drop this head across the channel today. But the rockets, V1, V5, there's a difference in it. And of course, they're working on all types of their Saarbrücken, that the big industrial city. That's one we liberated and got presidential. That's where all the scientists were working. They trying to develop a bomb. And that's where all the rockets were going on.
So that's when you guys got your unit citation?
Hmm?
Was that when you got your presidential unit citation?
Yeah. Liberation of Saarbrücken.
You're talking about the machine gun being set up in the manure pile. Makes you wonder what that guy did to upset his sergeant to be told to set up in the manure pile. Because you know that wasn't a voluntary action. Like, this looks good. He had to do something to make somebody angry to make him say, you're going over there. Not next to it. Right in the thick of it.
And if they were, heaven knows that, I don't know why, when I'm being asked or interviewed or something, their favorite is the flag deal. You want to talk about? You want to tell them about that?
You can talk about that. The littlest flag.
Yes,
yeah,
please.
The liberation of that French town. Yeah, and the French consulate up here in Tampa. Yeah. We had a little ceremony to recognize that event in his.
Twice he came, visited me, presented me with Warren. Then she came for my birthday. The big blowout. They roped off. What was it?
Lowe's parking lot.
Lowe's, they roped that thing off, huge tent. People come from all over the place. I had generals from Pentagon, and they got letters from General Franks. He stood next to the chief of staff.
Was that last October?
Huh?
Last October, on your birthday? John Skeen Day?
Well, that wasn't on John Skeen Day, but this was a different day.
But it was a couple days after.
Yeah.
In fact, we had a World War II Jeep that was actually with the 1700th Division that came down from around Lakeland.
Yeah.
I think a nephew and a grandson.
Three boys.
Of folks that John fought with.
Three boys. They had a Jeep. He got a barn. I've never seen it. He's got a tank and an artillery piece, and I don't know all kinds of stuff in it. But this Jeep, they come down, the three brothers came down, and that's what I rode in the...
That's awesome.
No, I didn't ride in that, but it's on display there. But people came all over the place. I had a motorcycle group from Jacksonville came over, and after it was over with, they lined up like a bread line. Congratulate me and everything and so forth. So when they got up, this big gold guy, you know how they looked.
Yeah.
He said, "Sir," he said, "we're a group from over in Jacksonville," and said, "the qualifications for being in our group is to see actual combat and face to face the enemy." And he said, "I picked you up on the internet or something," said. "So we've come over to see you and talk to you," and they all congratulated me there.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, this celebration was set up by Tom and Rich, who are two of the folks that we have our Bob Evans Breakfast Brigade that we have breakfast with every Thursday morning, and Captain Tom Carter and Rich, a Vietnam veteran, both helped set up that event. And we got the word out to folks to be there at the Lowe's parking lot. But
you know, we met there on that particular Thursday morning. And after it was over with, I got in a chair and started wheeling me out. And they wheeled me outside and didn't go towards the car. They were wheeling out in the middle of the road. And two guys got a hold of me and started pushing me. I said, "Where are we going?" They pushed me out into the road. Went down to Lowe's. And they had this thing roped off, had this huge, big tent, and they had other tents there, and they had a podium and platform. The French consul came down. She was one of them that came down again, second time. I thought that was most unusual. I appreciate it. But what it was, it was supposed to be not only my birthday, but in an experience that I had, dealing with the American flag. One Thursday morning, we were talking down there, and somebody said, "Did you see that guy taking that American flag and ripping it and then throwing it on the street and stomping on it?" That three or four. And somebody said, "Yes, they picked it up." And it turned to me and said, "Well, what do you think of that, John?" And I said, "When I look at the American flag, there's emotions that goes through me that it's hard to explain to anyone." And they said, "What do you mean?" And so I told them I didn't think it'd go outside the room. No, it was everywhere. But anyway, I said, we took this little town named Tentlingen, T-E-N. Oh, I think Tentlingen, Essingland, all these little downtowns, you know.
Sure.
They said, "How do you remember those?" I said, "Well, I just no special, I don't make any special effort. I just remember that something happened there, and I tie it together." And so we took this little town that morning about noontime, and as his custom is, whenever we take a little town, we would call it. We were meeting in the center, all had a little town center. Most of them were typical little French, had a little courtyard and a fountain in the middle and a flagpole, you know, all of them. So, and usually when we'd take a town, we'd pull down anything that looked like in the way of Nazi, we'd tear it down, everything. Of course, we'd pull the flag down off the flagpole. And this one town, they pulled it, the captain called all the people in and passed out the paper explaining to them what they could do now. They could join together with their families, but they couldn't travel outside, but they could hold meetings and do whatever you wanted to do, listen to the radio or anything like that. But they'd get set some rules until American can come up and organize the government again and help. So we pulled the flag down, and the captain said, turned to one of the sergeants there, one of the, in my platoon, he said, where's your flag? He said, okay, we carried two or three flags in the Jeep, always did, for to replace and to put up once we took a town. And so he went and came back, and he said, we've used up all the flags. We don't have any more. And the captain said, what, no flag? And I said, yes. And he said something to the effect that, anybody have an American flag? And a lady standing at the edge of the crowd with the little boy said, yes, I've got one. And he said, well, where is it? And she said, it's at the house. She said, can't go get it. So she said, spoke to the little boy, and he went down the cobblestone street, and he's gone 3 or 4 minutes. And he came back and got his little box. And he opened up the box, and here was this little American flag, about the size of the lid there.
Yeah.
And he opened it up, and there, but it was made from his mother's undergarments.
Wow.
And so the guy said, well, I can't, that's not the, captain said, the boy and the woman says it's an American flag. He said, it looks to me like the colors are there, and you could, it is an American flag. He said, let's put it on a pole. And so guy took it, painted it, punched a couple holes in it, and another took his shoestring out and tied the to the rope, the line, and he started to pull it up. The captain said, hold on, said, that little boy made that flag, let him raise it. And so it's a calm day, actually. It was just about like out there. And so he raised it, said, real slow, and he raised that his big tall flagpole, raised it all the way up to the top, and then tied it off. And a little wind picked up, and that thing started away. Everybody just started shouting and hollering, and the gals, the women dancing and throwing, they had some wine, they passing it around everybody. But yeah, when I see that little flag, yeah, and I look out my window, my American flag, it brings back such wonderful memories, you know, that something like that. I had an experience of seeing going through something like that. It meant a whole lot to me. Because you wonder, what in the world am I doing here in an unforgotten place, thousands of miles away on a piece of ground or something that's worthless? You know, all kinds of thoughts go through your mind. But sometimes something happens, and it makes it clicks. That makes it, you say to yourself, well, that is worthwhile. And the people today, the young generation, they don't know what a lot wonderful life they have and how much it cost them, who paid for it. I think of my buddy, a lot of people say to you, John, all the attention that I'm getting, I'm just an old ex-West Virginia hillbilly. I'm nobody special. I don't consider myself special. But everybody seems to think so and awards me all these honors. And the ladies kiss me. I get more kisses than ever. I tell my daughter, I said, I've got more kisses in the last month I've received all my life. But, you know, it does make a while. But somebody paid for what they're enjoying, and they just got they're concentrating on that pony most of the time. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in history. Don't seem like to be.
Well, while we're on the topic, I was thinking about that earlier. I'm 45. I've seen a lot of technology in my time. But I look at someone like you, you've seen it all. From before the telephone, before, you know, before TV, to now we have internet. I got people in other countries will be listening to this podcast. You were saying earlier that you guys were communicating with Germans, you know, for these reunions via email. When you sit back and think of how much technology change you've seen in your life, what's that like?
Astonishing. I just had, you know, it's mind-boggling. And I think sometime we'd be better off to be back where we were rather than now. Because history's not being taught in schools, you know, a lot of them, things like that. They're not interested in history. Surprisingly to me, one of the things that happened, I just could not believe it. I have two daughters at Michigan State University. They're professors. I know a lot of professors there. I go on and off. I had up until the past two years, I'd go half a dozen different times. I'd go up, I had a season ticket to baseball, to football and basketball, they do too. I've met the coaches and the players, and I've been honored up there on ESPN and all the major sports. They had a big celebration for my 100th birthday. And there I, after the colored guard left and the big resume of my service, you know, went around on the overhead thing, there I stood, I got the picture there, there I stood alone. And it was all of the 17,000 fans there, I felt like the loneliest person in all the world.
Yeah.
But it just, it hurts me sometimes. It really does. You won't be able to understand unless you was there and with your buddies, and those buddies, you know, that they would be the last to think that they did anything extra. The ones that I'm talking about that was killed. And when I go back each time, I always go to the St. of Old Cemetery. We still have 70th Division men there. I have one of my own platoon. Most of the others have been back, but that's the largest American cemetery in Europe. 11,500 buried there. Far as the eye, it's a little slope, beautiful place. If you can call that, far as you can see, are those crosses. So each time I go back, I check in at the information. I get the layout. I walk down the path to lane so and so, go down lane so and so to a certain row so and so, and I go over. And there is my son. Squad leaders. Anyway, he has a date and so forth on. And I'm lost. I'm completely lost. Speechless. I just cannot. It's something. And I tremble and shake. And this last time I had two other fellows with me. They left me. I just, no conversation. It's just, you'd hear a pin drop in the distance, maybe a little ruffle of the wind, or maybe a bird chirp. But what a place that is. You just can't believe it. But anyway, I just dropped to my knees, and I talked to Henny, and I said, Henny, your old sergeant, it's just your old sergeant here. Come back to see you. Those are the person who should be on, not me, no. I'm sorry.
No. I'm just sitting here thinking that we greatly appreciate you telling us these stories so that people can remember. Because that's one of the things I do with this podcast and being a living historian is we're trying to, as you said, you know, they don't teach us stuff in school because they got so much to cover that people like me we go to museums and events and we set up everything in an effort to help people remember and to educate. And so when we have the opportunity to sit down with a gentleman such as yourself, yes, we're celebrating you, but we're giving you the opportunity to celebrate those who can't tell their story now. And so I want to thank you for that.
Well, you and so many others, Kevin, I just can't get over. You're so kind and generous and so helpful. There's so many good people too. You just hear about the bad thing and bad, but there's so many good people who are interested in, and it makes you feel good to know that that there's still those out there who appreciate the effort that we put forth. Nothing special, like I say. Uncle Sam called me. I went, answered the call. I went where he told me to go. I did what he told me to do. And all these other experiences that just fell in, wasn't under my control.
Before we wrap it up, I was doing some research on the 275th last night, and I came across this document that I thought maybe you would be interested in hearing a little bit of it. Does the name the AT Weak Knee mean anything to you?
AT what?
Weak Knee.
Weak Knee.
So this website got a hold of a page out of the 70th Infantry Division Trailblazers newsletter. And it was issued right around the time. It's called the AT Weak Knee. And it has a couple of stories in it. And I just wondered if some of these names meant anything to you. Here's a description of the regimental commanders had dinner with the company. So the regimental commander, Colonel Dyke, and Captain Brown honored the company by having a dinner with the company officers on 22nd of April 11th, 1945. There's quite a bit of confusion in the company. However, on the part of the officers before the visit by Colonel McAlley, McAller, does that name sound familiar?
No, he must have been one of the regimental commanders.
How about Captain Sowers?
If that were him.
So, let's see here. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. So before the big meal, they had a practice meal so they could get used to having table manners and getting used to being together. So the practice meal got off with a grand rush when everyone dashed and grabbed their chair. Lieutenant Solomon bellowed, "Pass the goddamn meat." And at the same time, Lieutenant Myers and Andries grabbed for it. Those German dishes must be well made to stand such a enthusiasm strain. While the three were fighting over the meat, Lieutenant Fallis, does that name sound familiar?
He must have been in one of the other regiments.
Lieutenant Fallis dumped raisins into the potatoes and with two slices of bread in one hand and started eating with the other, using a tablespoon, taking huge gulps of coffee from the pot between bites. Captain Sowers, during this misbehavior of his officers...
Sowers, S-A-V-E-R-A-N-Z.
S-O-W-E-R-S? Sowers?
Oh, S-O-W-E-R-S. Yeah.
Captain Sowers, during this misbehavior of his officers, had been sitting looking and thinking. Suddenly, he stood up and called, "Attention!" Of course, the officers all came to and stood standing and bidding versions. I guess camp bidding. The captain proceeded to give a at ease and said, "If I remember correctly, this is not the way gentlemen eat at home." They all replied, "Hell no." Lieutenant Solomon, "I just knocked the hell out of the..." "Hell no," burst out Lieutenant Solomon. "I just knocked the hell out of both of them and eat it myself." All got quiet and the meal was progressing reasonably well when in comes old Lieutenant Davies. Does that name sound familiar?
That might be from other regiments, like 275.
In came old Davies, who was looking in the corner behind the furniture.
Dykes, D-Y-K-E-S?
Dykes was in here, but no. Davies came in and was looking in the corner behind the furniture. "What the hell are you looking for?" Lieutenant Myers yelled. "My waiter, sir," meekly replied Sergeant Davis, and leaves. The meal was finished without a great deal of any more confusion. But yeah, I just found this this whole article is talking about so many different men from the 275th and the 274th.
Yeah, I think it was 274, I figured that's where they're from. Oh, 07.
Yeah, but it was pretty interesting. Well, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Well, I have time on hand, you know, and it's better than just, I try to stay as active as I can. I get out every, I'll go over here 2 hours at the Pittsburgh Pirates training facilities right down here. I go over there and talk to those millionaires.
Yeah.
I was over there yesterday and found out one of the fellas, he was drafted last year by the Pittsburgh Pirates. He's the second one that was drafted by the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I was telling Kevin, I said, you know what, how much he got? $7 million. Number one got $10
million. Yeah.
And he got $7 million. And he got 18, 19 years old there. But I tell you, but I go over there all the time. And just like I say, I'm associate member. I can get back in where the other people can't get. I can go over there any day during the week. They have a snack bar or anything. I can get back in. I can, you know, screen and talk to different people, associate members. But I just can't sit and watch TV. I just can't do that.
Well, I believe that's why you've had the benefit of having a 105th birthday. I've heard oftentimes that it's keeping yourself busy and having stuff to do, giving yourself a purpose is what allows for people to have a long life. It's
well, you know, when I moved here, I like to say I was quite an athlete. I was a good golfer. I carried a 74 handicap, which is pretty good, you know, for an amateur. I love to fish. And all these things, and then I volunteered out to a Gothic mission, a missionary village that the owner of Tropicana built for missionaries that are coming back off the field and don't have any pension.
Sure.
Or not anything. And it's a wonderful place, and on it they have the manufacturing facilities which bring in translators from different countries. They translate with a translator. They manufacture the cassettes and everything, pack them, ship them out all over the world, free of charge, not a cent to anybody. And I just retired about 4 years ago. I was an enlisted volunteer, 21 years. I worked for DuPont. I was a mechanical engineer.
Okay.
I retired. And just, I was there when they put the equipment in. RCA came in and put in all the money. So I oversaw all of that. And so I continued to volunteer. My wife, she sat on the line when the album was opened, just be sure that the right album, each cassette and the number of the book, whatever it might be, Genesis, so many chapters, you have to cut it off in the equipment machine. All I oversaw, so I just stayed there, and my wife went out to work too. Well, it's an interesting thing. One day I was sitting here at, I might say, I met Mr. Rossi. I went to Calvary Baptist Church out there. I met Mr. Rossi. He was on the deacon board, deacon. So I was appointed a deacon, and that's how I met Mr. Rossi. And did you ever hear of him?
No, sir.
He's the founder and manufacturer. He's an immigrant. Came over here, didn't have a dime in his pocket. In New York City, started driving a cab, and he washed the dishes in a restaurant. And he come from an agriculture area in Italy, and so he's interested in that, you know. So he went to the library and got books and found out about the fruit growing in it. So he came down, he was selling calls on a little stand on the street. But that's how he got started.
Yeah.
He just didn't want to see those he thought there was something important still about an orange that you just couldn't throw it away. So he started getting the ones that didn't look perfect, you know, made it into juice. He started doing a little factory over here across there And then Larry, oh, he was a smart man. He designed all the equipment and everything, man. He designed the refrigerator system for the railroad company to ship this in. He designed the refrigeration for the ship. When the blight came for 2 years and there was nothing here, he bought a ship, put in a refrigerating unit, built a wharf in Texas. He said, brought that in. But anyway, he and I became good friends. So I was sitting here one day, and I got this call from board directors. They were meeting downtown in the big office, a whole huge office there right across from the courthouse. And the chairman said, Mr. Rossi, would you like to talk to you? Are you free? Can you come over? I said, oh, yeah. So I went over there and sat there a minute, and the chairman said, well, Mr. Rossi, tell him what you want. And he still had this, I tell you, bro, he said, he called me Jonathan. He said, Mr. Jonathan, I wanted you to go to work for me. And I looked at him, I said, go to work? I'm working for you. Oh, he said, I don't mean it that. Yes, sir, volunteer. Said, I want to put you on a payroll. Said, I give you a car, whatever expenses you need. See, they sent out to jails and schools and displays and when people were having conventions and so forth, all the way to Africa. He designed a recording instrument about that big, about that. It had a little, what you call it in it, and you. When it got out of the boondocks, you just crank, you put the cassette in, and then you crank, had a little generator, and you crank, and you get the voice. He got a team over there that take those out into the boondocks, and these natives would come in from everywhere, you know, and then they'd show the screen. So, but see, that's what I was involved in, and what he had the village. So I told him that, and he's, oh, he was a big man. He had a finger that looked like a barrel at the end of a gun. He leaned across the table there and said, Mr. Jonathan, hear me good. Said, you don't never retire from the Lord's work. I told him, I said, oh, no, I can't take it. I've talked it over with my wife. We know what, we were having a great time. We took two cruises a year, and then we'd travel out west and visit. We just on the go all the time. But I said that, and he told me that, and I said, oh, Mr. Ross, I said, I don't know about that. I said, I'd have to go home, talk it over with my wife, this thing. I said, that'd be more than I'd expect. So I came home. My wife says, nothing doing. She says, we were retired. That's what we retired for. So that was the hardest thing I ever had to do to go back to tell him that. But he accepted. I said, I'll continue to work, and I will. And I did. But they brought in another fellow to overlook the... I've had a lot of wonderful experiences with people, I tell you.
Like
I say, I golf, I fish, and I just on the go all the time, you know.
This has been a Digital 410 production.